Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil, how are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, doing real good.
Hey, a happy belated future day to you.
And you as well. It was on the 1st, wasn't it? March the 1st.
March 1st, future day. I noted it on Facebook with my usual comment on future day, which is I wish it had a better name and a date that meant something, but I like the idea of future day. So did you do anything to celebrate future day?
I'm putting it off, you know, to the future.
Oh, okay. I plan to celebrate future days.
Yeah, I plan to. hey, we're all about the future all the time. So, you know, maybe we should plan a future day show, maybe for next week or something.
Well, actually, next week we've got a huge show. We're going to be talking with our astronaut to Mars, potentially. Here's my take on future day. Have you ever asked, as a child, did you ever ask this question of a parent? How come there's a Mother's Day and a Father's Day, but there is no Children's Day? Did you ever ask an adult that question? Because
yes,
there's a very stock answer.
Every adult gives the same answer. It's like a programmed response, right?
The answer is? Together.
Every day.
Every day is Children's Day. That's right.
That's right.
Well, around here, every day is Future Day, okay? So
right.
It's nice that some people have marked off March 1st, and we honor it, but it's also Future Day today, as far as I'm concerned. Today is the day, I believe, is what we say at the beginning of every show, and I firmly believe that. Also, I think there's something about a holiday that almost has to be backward-looking. The word commemorate means to remember a thing, right? It means to look at something that occurred in the past. I'm not sure that you can commemorate the future in exactly the same way. You can anticipate, right? So what our friends have done in putting together Future Day is they've attempted to create an anticipatory holiday. And I think it's a noble idea. It's a great idea. And to get people focusing on the future. But it really goes against the grain of what holidays are and why people celebrate holidays, doesn't it? Or does it? Maybe I'm let me not put those words in your mouth. What do you think?
Well, I could see. You remember 20 years ago, Future Day, now it's gotten all commercial,
Exactly. That's right.
You could just see that.
Wait till the greeting card companies get a hold of Future Day. Am I right? It's going
to be. That's right. Yeah, Future Day was so much better, pre-singularity. Now it's just,
Now it's all just. Well, the AIs just took it over, and they made it their thing.
They ran with it, and, what are we moshes going to do now? So.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm just bitter because I had ideas about Future Day that I proposed, and none of my ideas went anywhere with the people who were setting it up. But, for example, one of my ideas was, time it with the solstice, right, the changing of the seasons. To me, that would make sense, right? It's like, let's do it the solstice, the equinox, right? Put it right the first day of spring. Wouldn't that be a great day for Future Day? the first day of spring, you know, it's like the world's coming to life. I think, you know, that kind of anticipatory feeling would be built in. March 1st, I mean, I don't know why they picked it, but it just doesn't scream the future to me. Or even
hey, it should have been March 4th.
Okay. Now, why is that?
March 4th into the future. Right. I'm sorry. Bad pun, but yeah.
Or May 4th. Excuse me. You're supposed to call it May the 4th. But actually, no, again, that's commemorating a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, folks, we're not going to explain it. Yeah, no, don't do it. Don't go there. But anyway, I'm glad it exists. I'm glad that people are becoming more aware of the future, that they're thinking about it. And I hope Future Day turns into something. You know, it needs some activities. Remember like Festivus, right, where you had the feats of strength and the airing of grievances and you put out the poll and all that kind of stuff. I think Future Day needs some.
I've got a lot of problems with you people. Okay.
Well, obviously it would be that. It would be, you know, the airing of hopes or the airing of scenarios or, you know, something like that. But it needs a little bit of ritual or, I don't know, somehow it needs to be a little more grounded in something. I think it would be more appealing to the masses. And I think that's where they want to go with it, right, by having a future holiday. Because if it's just a geek holiday, it doesn't really matter. We've already got some geek holidays. You know, there's Evolaterra, right? July 20th, the day we celebrate, you know, there's Yuri's Night, right? There are already some commemorative geek holidays that kind of speak to the future. This one, we were hoping, would have a broader appeal. Well, I think if they want it to have broader appeal, they're going to have to juice it up a little bit. I don't know what the answer is. I've already given my suggestions. So if they don't like mine, I don't know. Steven, help them out. Give them some.
Yeah, we'll weigh in. And I tell you what you do and the way a tradition has started is you just do it yourself. And if it's good enough, if your ideas, you know, can take hold, then, you know, more people take it on. And there you go. That is
a great idea. Okay, Steven, here's what we're going to do.
We just
next
celebrate.
Next year, I'm going to implement some future day tradition. I want you to do the same. We won't talk about it until the show, and then we'll talk about what we did, okay? And anyone listening who also wants to implement their own future day tradition starting next year, you can then write in or, you know, let me know ahead of time, and we'll bring you on the show, and we'll talk about it after the fact, and we'll compare, you know, we'll see who's got which potential traditions look like they have legs. Because we're obviously in early days. I mean, this is the second future day, right?
Yeah.
Because last year, you and PJ and I, we did a whole show about, you know, what would be good songs for Future Day. And
that's right. Go caroling on Future Day. That'd be great.
Exactly.
Wars,
and I don't know that any of those have caught on, so we need to revisit the music. It needs music. It needs food, right? It needs
a
pole or a tree or something. Anyhow, it's getting there. It's getting there. We'll work on Future Day year by year. We'll see if we can't turn it into something. Well, okay, Future Day isn't really our topic this evening, or is it? Actually, tonight we're remembering one of the great actors of I'm going to say one of the great TV actors of the 20th century, which would be of all time then, really, Leonard Nimoy, the man who played Spock on Star Trek, passed away last week, and hit me pretty hard, I got to say. We're going to talk a little bit about Leonard Nimoy. We're going to talk a little about Spock tonight.
You know, it was comparable to me, Phil, the reaction I had. It was comparable to me to Robin Williams in a way. And completely different, you know, people. But affected me in similar ways. You know, you never met these people. You know, and never thought that I would. It was, you know, it's just, you know, they're part of the world is a different part of the world. But I felt a connection with both Robin Williams and Leonard Nimoy. What they gave of themselves in their performances. I don't think that it was just a job, you know, punching in and punching out every day. I think they were true artists, and So that's, you know, that's and the character of Spock is truly iconic. I mean, that, you know, I think the character of Spock will be with us, you know, from now on, in the way perhaps Sherlock Holmes is with us. You know, it's
yes.
An important character I don't know what you say about that, but you have that person or that idea of a person in your head at times, you know, when the situation comes up that requires that. I don't know what I'm saying, but it's just a he was a truly a character.
No, he's like it's the point of being an archetype almost, right? It's Spock was a character that eventually somehow we would have known about, but it's like we needed Leonard Nimoy to make him exist for us. And
right.
Now there's another actor who plays him. Zachary Quinto plays him now, and others will play him probably at some point in the future, and then digital renditions will be offered up, and there will be other versions of Spock. But everything will hail back to this performance of this actor on a TV show in the 60s. I mean, because
that's right.
That created that character. I mean, that really made that character real. And it goes to the fact that TV and film are always this very collaborative art. And, you know, Spock was the creation of Gene Roddenberry and the people who wrote for Star Trek, but very much the creation of Leonard Nimoy as well. I mean, the identification between the two is something that, I mean, we called the show Farewell Spock. Well, actually, Spock's not going anywhere, right? He'll still be with us. We're saying goodbye
right.
to the actor. And it's very interesting to me that Nimoy, among all the other books he wrote, you know, he was a poet. He wrote books on a lot of different subjects, but he wrote two books about his own life. He wrote two autobiographies, the first one in 1975 with the title I Am Not Spock, the second one in 1995 with the title I Am Spock. Okay, so it goes to show you that when we identify him with that character, it's not out of line with, I guess, how he looked at it, is it?
Well, I think he was telling the truth both times, right? I mean, there was much more to Leonard Nimoy than Spock, and certainly to the people that knew and loved him, I'm sure. But, you know, there was a lot of Leonard Nimoy in Spock, and, I don't think you had to know, you know, I don't think you had to know the man to see that. A lot of that man came through performance, I think. You know, I think the turbulent time of the 60s made that character, you know, I mean, you could have written that character at any other time in history, mm-hmm. probably. But one of the reasons I think he was latched onto was the turbulent time that he was, you know, came to the attention of, you know, of our culture. A creature of pure logic, you know, at a time when things look like they're going to hell, you know. I
think that was very appealing, wasn't it? The idea that you would function purely by logic. And also, I think what makes the character work is some sense that it's a facade, right?
Right.
Because we know Spock
is
half human.
He's not a robot. He's not a robot.
Yeah.
He is,
and that there's the human half lying just under that. I mean, that's part of what made that show so unique. I don't know if you've seen this documentary that William Shatner did. I think it's called Captains, something like that. It's Shatner interviewing all the other captains of the Enterprise or people who were captains on Star Trek. So it also includes, you know, from Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he's talking to, I'm sorry, I can't think of the actor's name, but he was on the Star Trek series that the last Star Trek TV series. What was
okay,
it called?
Scott Bakula. And,
Scott Bakula, thank
Star Trek
you.
Star Trek Enterprise, yes.
Enterprise, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. So yeah, he's talking to Scott Bakula, Star Trek Enterprise, and Bakula's talking about how he used to watch the original series in the 60s, and he and, you know, all his friends, they would all, not in the 60s, it's probably like in the 70s. He's watching it, you know, in reruns.
In syndication, yeah.
In college. And Shatner's, you know, asking, what is it that was so appealing to you about the show? And a really interesting answer that he gave was, you know, it's not necessarily the optimistic vision of the future or the special effects or, you know, the alien worlds or the action scenes, which those are all good reasons to have liked that show, and I like it for all those reasons. But it was the relationships, you know. It was the buddy nature between McCoy, Kirk, and Spock. There was a real unique kind of bromance, I guess, going on, you know, between those three guys. Kind of an interesting dynamic with Spock on the one side, the perfectly rational guy. McCoy, the real humanist kind of guy, right? He's hard-nosed, but he's also probably the softest touch among all of them, because he's the doctor and he's always looking at the, you know, the empathetic view and how people feel about things. And right in the middle, you got Kirk, who has a job to be done, right? So the relationship between those three, and especially the relationship between Kirk and Spock, made that show really unique. And I don't think they ever captured anything quite as good as that in any of the subsequent Star Trek shows, obviously it did recur in the movies. I think that's one of the things that makes the original Star Trek show special, the original Star Trek series special, is that that relationship, especially between Kirk and Spock, just that that give and take between the you know, the impetuous, passionate leader Kirk and the coolly rational, you know, technocrat scientist Spock. They never quite nailed that. Data was a really interesting character, and you know, the dynamics between Picard and Data is interesting, and you see,
Worf,
a lot of
Worf,
absolutely, you know, going kind of in a different direction. I don't mean to demean any of that, but I don't think anything was ever quite as pure as what those two pulled off in that series. And what made it possible was really the acting chops that those three, and especially those two, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, brought to it. And then that carried on into the movies, particularly the second and third Star Trek movies, Star Trek II and III, you know, where that relationship really plays, and IV, I suppose, to a lesser extent. It really takes center stage.
Two, three, and four are a trilogy in my mind. I always think two, three, and four are a single story. And, let me just ask you, looking back on it, do you still watch the original series ever? Or do you limit your original crew viewing to the movies?
Oh, no, I actually, once in a while, is it still on Netflix? While it was on Netflix,
yeah.
I loved watching them with the revamped special effects.
I still watch
the old ones. I still watch Next Generation whenever it comes on. I don't much watch Enterprise or Deep Space Nine or Voyager, I must say. But I still watch the original series when it comes on, and I still, you know, if I'm flipping channels and it's there, I'll watch it probably. Or Next Generation. How about you?
Yeah, I'm exactly pretty much the same way. I tuned in to kind of, you know, check out the new special effects that they put into to the original series, and was impressed with the light touch that they had. It didn't seem to, you know, ruin anything. I was afraid that they, you know, that they would kind of take away some of the campiness, and, you know, that made the original series fun.
Well, he didn't
you know?
Want it to become one of those, like, George Lucas remakes of one of his own
exactly.
movies, right? Where the
exactly,
special effects are
know.
Just clobbering you over the head, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to have to buy a Spock shot first T-shirt, you know what I'm saying? And
exactly.
But they didn't. They had a kind of a light touch on that, made it look better, and not just the digital special effects, but also cleaned it up, and the audio too, visually and the audio were all cleaned up. And. And so, yeah, I enjoyed that. I have not watched them all, but I probably enjoyed a good half dozen since they started, you know, bringing those back out. So, Good stuff.
And
good
obviously stuff. Some are much better than others. I mean, there are some real stink bombs in the original series. There's no question about it. And just some really
Spock
flat
brain.
Yeah, well, Spock's brain is kind of a famous dud
famous
episode.
For being bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And just some kind of flat ones that don't really go anywhere. But some real moments of brilliance too in that show,
right.
and some pretty daring stuff that they tried. I think braver in a lot of ways, more daring in a lot of ways than Next Generation ever was, or any of the subsequent series ever were. But it had the first mover's advantage, right? I mean, it was really setting all that stuff out there. So I think that I think it kind of sets it apart that way. Also, William Shatner is just so much fun to watch. He's always great. And when he and Nimoy are kind of sparring, I just think, you know, that's excellent TV. Whatever else is going on, you know, people are having all the salt sucked out of their body, or, you know, they're about to fall into another dimension, or whatever else is going on. Those two made the show really interesting to watch. Made it.
You know, what was great was sometimes the sparring would be as simple as an arched eyebrow from Leonard
Right.
Nimoy.
Right.
You know, he'd be registering with Kirk that, you know, what are you doing? with just a look. It was a great show. It really was.
Yeah, you know, the one criticism, if I would even let it rise to the level of calling it a criticism, that I have of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which really celebrates the friendship between Kirk and Spock, is that it missed out on maybe that aspect of their relationship, right? That we only see them as really good close friends. We don't see the tension. I mean, you get it with McCoy, obviously. It's always going to be there with McCoy, you know, green-blooded hobgoblin kind of comments that he makes. But because in that movie, they kind of pass that role on to Savick. And they let Savick be the kind of skeptical, I don't think this human knows what he's doing person. And I guess they had sort of shown that at this point, Spock didn't need to play that role anymore. Okay, I've talked myself into it. That's not a problem with Star Trek II. We can move on. It's okay.
Well, yeah, and that really was a continuation of the character arc from the Star Trek I, the motion picture. You recall in that one that Spock had this revelation when he met Beecher face-to-face, that, hey, Beecher lacks something, and that's friendship, you know?
Right, right.
And that's an important part of my me, and, you know, and he kind of embraced that. And so I think you see that in Star Trek II. So,
I never thought about that. It's true. There are little bits of continuity between those two movies. Mostly Star Trek II was kind of like the please forget Star Trek I, but they really did carry some stuff over, didn't they?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, well, so we've got this list of top 10 best Mr. Spock quotes. So it's from the most credible source you can get a top 10 list from. It's from top10best.com. So...
And these are actually very good. I think
they are too. Yeah. I thought we'd just go through some of these, and we can start with number 10. Here's what I want to do. I want to talk about the questions that I posed in the show description. One of which is, does Spock still matter? Right. Is Spock still a character that we need to think about? Does he still have anything interesting to tell us about the future, or is Spock now a past future? Or can he even tell us anything about the world we live in today, right? And finally, what would Spock have to say about the subjects typically discussed on the world transform? So I thought we'd use these quotes from mostly from the original series to kind of talk about those aspects of Spock. So here's number 10. Computers make excellent and efficient servants, but I have no wish to serve under them. All right, that's from Star Trek, the original series, The Ultimate Computer is the name of
one of the great, one of the great episodes in the original series, as I recall. And was that from the first season?
I'm not really sure. Yeah.
They had some really good writing in the first, and maybe to a lesser extent the second season.
Yeah, it kind of went bad in the third.
Not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of. kind of went bad in third. But, yeah, well, I tell you, I think that goes to the issue of whether an AI will ever be a person as you and I are people.
Right.
And so in that future, Spock is saying no, that the computers are still not people, not in the sense that we are. And I don't really think, maybe until Data shows up, that that Star Trek embraced the possibility of AI.
Right.
And so that was maybe a limitation of the vision, maybe a failing of the original vision of Star Trek. But it was, you know, Star Trek was always very humanist. You know,
yes.
The human adventure is just beginning. Was the tagline in one of the first movies. One of the movies.
Yeah.
And so it's always been about that. I would think that if I was going to disagree with any of these quotes from Spock, it might be this one. That, you know, someday I think that computers may be as realized individuals as we biological folks are. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this quote speaks to the fact that Star Trek, for all of its forward-lookingness and its optimism about the future, Star Trek was not and has had a hard time trying to become a transhumanist vision of the future. It never really was. And to the extent that AI is a big part of that, it really was not, you know, it was not there in the original series. I think there were instances where you had a computer that really seemed to be feeling something, but it would always turn out that was kind of a facade. It was a sham. Ultimately, the message was what Spock seems to be telling us here is that, you know, that's just a machine and I'm something different. Whereas, to its credit, in The Next Generation, you have Data, a character who challenges that idea, a character who says, I'm not something different. Or if I'm something different, I'm something different the way, like, all these aliens are different, but I'm as much like you as they are, and I'm as much entitled to personhood as they are. So that was a big step forward. But then when it comes to other transhuman issues, you would see The Next Generation kind of falling down. I mean, when they talk about life extension, it's always presented in a bad light. One of my principal complaints with Doctor Who, okay, that show is so anti-transhumanist. It's like, it's cool that the Doctor is like this meta powerful being, but if anybody else wants to become one, they're always evil, right? Have you noticed this about Doctor Who? I'm sorry, we'll do that on another show.
Who is the character in the Star Trek universe who is biologically superior, mentally superior? It's Khan, right? So, Star Trek, at least as originally conceived, was definitely
right.
Exactly.
He's had all those modifications, and there's something wrong with that. Same within the Next Generation.
Yeah.
You got Q, who's this post-singularity being, right?
And
he's a bad guy. You know, when Q offers to make Riker a post-singularity being, I mean, they don't use that term, but that's basically what it is. When he says, here, Riker, you can transcend too, you know, the show says, oh, no, that would, you know, we can't go that way. So this is a great quote because I think it puts Star Trek in the right context, which is a forward-looking view of the future, but not quite transhumanism. You know, it falls short of... It falls short of a transhumanist vision, and I think that's fine. And by what he means by a computer, I agree with Spock completely, because what he means is a calculating machine. He means a machine that there's no there, there's no consciousness, ultimately just a very sophisticated set of algorithms that can emulate some of the processes of a human mind, but that is not a human mind. And I would agree that, you know, like a zombie at best, yes, something like that would make an excellent and efficient servant, but no way would I want something like that controlling my life. So, you know, to the extent that I can, I guess I agree with Spock on that one. Okay, how about number 9? This is from And the Children Shall Lead, also Star Trek, the original series. The quote is, without followers, evil cannot spread. Interesting.
It is very similar to the famous quote that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing.
Kind of a counterpoint to that, or a supporting point to that.
Yeah. I actually like Spock's quote maybe a little better. It's more pithy. It gets to the point, doesn't it? Without followers, evil cannot spread. And that's exactly true. You got meme theory all wrapped up in that too, don't you? You have to have a vessel for ideas, good or bad, to spread, and so you have to have followers. And the children so lead. Remind me of that episode. Is that the one with the like the hippie kids, or I forget?
I believe that one's from the first. You know what? I might be confusing it with Charlie X, but I think it's with the kids who they have these kind of psychic powers, right? And one of them, or a group of them, is a there's one of them who's kind of a ringleader, leading them off in a bad direction. I believe that's what Spock is referencing in that point. Yeah. Let's see here.
Yeah.
Let me see how close I got it. The Enterprise reaches a Federation colony where the adults have all killed themselves, but the children play without care. Remember, they go in that circle and they do that little dance and they're talking to the friendly angel and rings the bell. Yeah, it's actually not the kid as much as the friendly angel, who's actually this demonic alien presence that's led these kids in a bad direction. I'm sorry, spoilers. Excuse me. It's a 40-year-old TV show.
For a 40-year-old TV show, exactly. Come out of your cave. Anyway,
but I think that one speaks to the world we live in too, doesn't it? I mean, because we live in a world where followers are helping evil ideas to spread. It's happening in the world today. You can look around and see it. You can see it happen and know that exactly what you said. This whole idea of memes, ideas that get a hold of people can potentially get a hold of whole pieces of the world and really cause tremendous damage. And if you can do something to stop that, if you can do something to keep that from happening, I guess that's, to take it back to the original quote, the one about, good men to do nothing. That's kind of our job, right? Is to stand up against the evil that will spread if the followers are, given their way. Anyway, pretty profound quote for a sci-fi series from the 60s, huh?
That's right.
All right, how about this? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Going to number 8. Change is the essential process of all existence.
Now, that's profound.
It is profound.
To me, that is absolutely the human imperative, right?
Right.
That's what we talk about on this show every week. I think there's two ways of looking at the world. There's two ways of looking at life. One is that that the world essentially is static, and that things accidentally change from time to time, or erratically or sporadically change. And the other way to look at it is that things are always in motion, always changing. And that actually, if there's any period of stasis, that is the exception. And what Spock is speaking to is that viewpoint, and that's very much our viewpoint. I mean, this is the reason we have this show, I think, pretty much.
Yeah, and it's a recognition of the fact that not only is it important, but to the extent that you're resisting it, you are basically removing yourself from the flow of history. Basically, you're disqualifying yourself from contributing to the way things are going to go. If you're not a part of the change process. So, very profound quote. And there's a whole show or two or series.
Yeah, it's a great
that we could
quote.
Do on that.
Kind of a cheesy Star Trek episode, if you ever saw it. It's the one where, talk about, the fact that we're in the 60s. and this is, I believe, is from that third season. It's the characters, the aliens, who one group is, their face is black on one side and white on the other, and the other is white on one side and black. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it was a pretty heavy-handed message about racism and race relations in America at that time and stuff. Good performance by Frank Gorshin, who was also the Riddler in the Batman series, if you remember that actor. But, you know, not a great episode of Star Trek, really. A little too preachy, a little too ham-handed, I think. A fantastic quote from Spock there.
Absolutely. Go ahead with number seven, then, I guess.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I got to bring it back up. I'm sorry. I've got several screens open.
Insufficient facts always invite danger.
Okay. Insufficient facts always invite danger. Now, this episode, Space Seed, I believe. I haven't looked.
It's one of the greats.
That's the original Khan episode, is it not?
Yes, it is. And... so it's one of the big episodes. If you don't watch too many episodes from the original series, this may be the one that you want to watch.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because it gets a sequel in the movie series, obviously. But insufficient facts always invite danger. What do you think, Phil?
Absolutely.
True?
Yeah. I there's a corollary to that.
Why we have a CIA?
Insufficient facts. If you don't know your situation, you're in trouble, right? Because you're going to be making assumptions,
right.
And you're going to, you're going to potentially lead yourself down the wrong path. I would say, though, that insufficient facts also invite opportunity. This would be my corollary to Spock's notion about inviting danger. If you don't know all the different ways you can fail, you can try things, right? But if you don't know all the reasons that you definitely will fail, you will try things you shouldn't try. I mean, you know, that's what I think Spock is getting at in laying out this line. But I mean, this is just like profound Eastern wisdom. You know, you would expect this to come from, the Art of War or something like that. I mean, it's just absolutely true, and obviously. Spock is talking in the context of, for those who haven't seen this episode, it's about the Enterprise has encountered this man from the 20th century who's very powerful. He becomes a threat to the ship. There's this question about whether he's going to take over and have his way. And he's a big unknown quantity. So Spock and basically the whole crew are trying to decipher this guy and trying to outwit him. And it's very hard to do because he is, as we discussed earlier, it's this Khan we're talking about. He's this modified man. He's been made stronger than a normal human. He's been made more intelligent than a normal human. And he's a really difficult character to contend with.
There is a quote, and I don't know who said it, but brings out the same idea. A strategy without metrics is just a wish.
Oh, okay.
And so I think that, you know, it's much the same idea there. The insufficient facts always invite danger. You have to be able to measure. What am I trying to say, Bill? It's just you have to be able to measure where you're going with something in order to get there properly.
In quality improvement programs in telecom back in the 80s, we used to say you can't improve what you can't measure, and it's the same kind of idea. Basically, that if you don't have the quantifiable information, you can't make the reasoned decisions that you need to make. And that's especially important for Spock, right? Because he wants to use logic. You need to have data. Yeah, you want to have data if you're gonna make a logical decision. Kirk, you know, give him three doors and ask him to pick what's behind one. Right? He's fine with that situation.
he'll blow open all three with his phaser. You know.
Yeah. He knows he's gonna come out okay. Spock really needs he needs that reassurance of the information.
I think Spock just founded the quantified self movement with this quote. You know, let's give him some credit. You know,
yeah, absolutely. Well,
yeah.
I think I would say this one speaks to the relevance of Spock in a different way, because we've talked about how Star Trek wasn't really a transhuman show. I mean, its philosophy really wasn't transhuman, but in the greater singularitarian transhumanist community, don't you feel like you're kind of dealing with Spock sometimes? I mean, you know, some of the folks out there, I think, have a very
Spock-like.
Yeah, they'd like to
yeah.
be Spock. Yeah, absolutely. They have a very Spock-like view of the world. And in fact, the character of Spock has sort of come true in this age of the ascendancy of the geek, right? Because
right.
Spock is, he's not socially awkward, but he's sort of an outsider. He's way smarter than everybody else, and he's driven by what goes on in his head, not driven by emotion. And I'll tell you that's the description of a person, okay? Not a person. That's the description of a lot of different people out there in the world generally, but kind of heavily concentrated in the singularitarian and transhumanist community. Geeks are like that. They're
yep.
Spock-like, or they want to be. They want to be Spock.
Asperger syndrome. I mean, you know,
yeah.
which is type of high functioning autism. People are, you know, those people tend to be like that. They tend to be very, very smart, and you know, they have some difficulty interacting with the world around them. They're, you know, Sheldon Cooper is a good example.
Who's as big a Spock fan as can be found, right?
That's right. That's him.
Yeah. But when you look at Sheldon, you know, hard time making the emotional connections, but brilliant at figuring everything else, and also just kind of a body of knowledge and a view of the world that kind of skews in the very highly technical and almost sort of arcane direction. So I think that when you ask, does Spock matter? I think in a lot of ways he matters more than ever, because we've got a world that's heading in a Spock direction in a lot of ways. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing necessarily. I think that Spock's a great character. So if there are people like Spock, that's cool. But it's a thing to be aware of, that the differences between Kirk and Spock are now differences that are kind of being played out to a certain extent on a societal level. And maybe we can go back and look at those Star Trek episodes, and maybe they have something to tell us about how we can get along as groups of people, and you know, how a brighter future can actually involve more than one kind of person. Anyway, let's move on. Here's one that I think is a fantastic example of the fact that we must never forget that every piece of Star Trek is always going to be a product of its times, okay? If you watch, you know, a Harv Bennett-directed Star Trek movie from the 80s, there's going to be a lot of explosions and gunplay and stuff like that. And if you watch a TV series from the 60s, there's going to be lines of dialogue such as the following: "I have never understood the female capacity to avoid a direct answer to any question." Now, let me tell you what's awesome about that is that sort of thing would have been offered up at that time. Kids listening along who are just convinced now that you know, this show is nothing about is about nothing but misogyny and hating women. In a humorous way, right? That was intended to be funny.
Yeah. Now, that was not intended to be a hateful thing at all. In fact, you can almost detect in that quote Spock's admiration. that females were apparently able to avoid a direct answer to whatever questions being offered. And that again, a product of its time. That sort of mild misogyny, you know, is say goodnight, Gracie. You know, goodnight, Gracie.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was you know, that was kind of, that was, you know, not meant to be, I don't know, hateful or anything. It was funny. And I think to a large extent, women of the time would laugh along with it.
I think,
you know,
so. Well, because I think it was less misogyny than it was a basic understanding of the world that the writer was coming from and the actor is coming from and delivering the line, which is that women and men are fundamentally different. Okay.
Right.
Now that idea is hotly debated today. Okay, and we're not going there because that would be a different.
But it
show.
Wasn't hotly debated back then, and
we'd need Paige PJ on. But yeah, it was not hotly debated back then. It was assumed that women and men were fundamentally different. That they were that not only are they biologically different, but that their basic, you know, dispositional makeup was different, that they approached the world differently. They had different strategies for how you go about the world. And this is Spock, you know, reflecting his frustration on that. And I think you're right. As much admiration in there and just recognition of the otherness of woman as disdain, although it's definitely a complaint, you know, so you can see where where it would be taken, where it would be taken bad. Now, but you gotta know the context of this one, This Side of Paradise. This is the episode where, I don't know if you've seen this one, where they're on this planet, and if they blow these spores in your face, suddenly you're just as happy as you can be, right? It's kind of like you've gone into the Nexus in the later Star Trek movie, and Spock is. You know, his whole Vulcan side is gone. He's just human, and he's just living on this planet. He's got a girlfriend and having a great time.
It's bonfire all year long, you know what I mean?
Exactly. So this statement has to come up either before or after, either before the spores or after he's cleared of the effects, because he's way too into it. In fact, it was Jill Ireland, the actress who plays his girlfriend, and I remember seeing an interview with him many years later talking about that. He said it was the one time he got to have kind of a romantic relationship on the show, and it was with Charles Bronson's wife. And of course Charles Bronson was on the set the whole time, so I guess he didn't get to enjoy it as much as he might have. Anyway, it's a really fun episode, and it's an early precursor to Spock kind of exploring his human side, which, as you mentioned, comes out later in the movies. And, you know, as far as never understanding the female capacity to avoid a direct answer to any question, all I can tell you is around my house, I get very direct answers to questions. So I can't.
Oh, gosh.
You know, there's no issue with it being too indirect.
Let's not go any further into that.
So right. I don't agree.
Next quote is, I realize that command does have its fascination, even under circumstances such as these, but I neither enjoy the idea of command nor am I frightened of it. It simply exists, and I will do whatever logically needs to be done.
Interesting.
Hello?
So this is obviously in the context of Spock, as happened occasionally, being thrown into the situation where he had to take command of the Enterprise, or theoretically, you know, hypothetically was going to have to. And what he's saying about command is, I think, really interesting there. This is the view we should all have, actually, about having responsibility over other people. It's not something that we should enjoy in and of itself. We should just know it's a thing that sometimes, you know, it's a mantle you have to take on at some point. So, in fact, what Spock is giving voice to there is, I think, a very traditional moral view of authority. I think it's something that you know, somebody from the Middle Ages would have said the same thing about a commander in an army or a prince ruling a city or something like that. That you don't want your self to be wrapped up in that. Rather, you want to see it as something that, you know, it's a job that has to be done, and when it has to be done, you go do it. Or am I misreading that? What do you think?
No, I think you got it. He said in one of the movies where basically Kirk was, you know, almost apologetically retaking command, And he says, Jim, I think you have the wrong idea. I have no ego to bruise.
Right.
And that was, I mean, one of the more appealing things about Spock is that, you know, he did not mind at all for Kirk to be the captain. And, he, I mean, out, an outstanding second command for that reason.
Right.
He reached the place that he was at in Starfleet, not because of ambition, the way Kirk did, but because of competence. He was
right.
just that competent. And of course, he held the rank. You know, in the later movies, he held the rank of captain. But generally, that was he was still second in command to Captain Kirk, so
right.
or Admiral Kirk,
right.
or whatever the rank Kirk held at the time.
Well,
so,
it's interesting. We've got to move on because we're going to run out of time. But it's interesting that that comes up in an episode where there's all this tension about Spock's not really human. He's on this shuttle with other members of the crew, and they're all like, you know. The tension in the episode is all about the fact that Spock isn't behaving the way they would expect a human who's ordering them around to behave. So it's all those issues about how different Spock is coming into play with him stating this very obvious difference between him and a more ambitious approach to leadership. But let's move on. How about this one? I love this line. This is from The Doomsday Machine. Vulcans never bluff. what's great about that? That's
course,
a mini. Go ahead.
I think he was saying that in the middle of bluffing. I mean,
he was bluffing at the time.
That was
absolutely
his bluff.
Yeah, that was the bluff. Vulcans don't lie, right? So as we learn in Star Trek, but he can exaggerate, right? He can.
That's right.
You know. He can change the scale units that he's talking in if he needs to. And Vulcans do bluff. They don't lie, but they definitely bluff. And he was bluffing when he said that. It's a great episode. And for those of you who really want to geek out, okay, that episode, the Starfleet officer that they're kind of up against, he's the father of Captain Decker in Star Trek One. Thank you very much. That's my geek points for the night. All right. So moving on to number two. This is from an episode called Errand of Mercy, and Spock says, "It is curious how often you humans manage to obtain that which you do not want." And I really wanted to get to this one because, again, Spock is saying some pretty profound stuff here, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, and you know that's there is some ancient Asian wisdom that you will meet your fate on the road you take to avoid it.
Right. Right.
Which I believe is a quote from Kung Fu Panda. But
there you go. Well, okay.
I take wisdom
where we find it. By golly. Yeah.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Exactly. But at any rate, that's and I think that's true. I think that you work and you struggle and you strive to end up getting what you don't want. And that was a quote from the original series, but I think that it could have been said of Kirk's character when he became admiral. You know, that's not what he wanted, not what he needed.
Right.
He needed to be a captain. So
right. Well, we talk a lot about the human imperative. We talk about this problem of unintended consequences. And Eliezer Yudkowsky actually puts it into a perspective that I think really helps explain it. It's the difference between human will and human volition, right? What we want and what we would want if we were smart enough to know what we want, right? It's a problem I think we're going to come up against more and more, but it goes back to, you know, the earliest days of being human. It's something that we've always encountered and always will encounter, which is just, you know, the fact that in attempting to get to the good stuff, we throw ourselves into these funky directions that, you know, we get exactly what we didn't want. You know, we get the opposite of the good stuff, or we get the good stuff and it turns out it's horrible, right? Tremendous wisdom on the part of the doctor. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it's sometimes the machine you build produces, you know, has consequences you didn't mean to. Okay, I'm moving quickly then to...
Just a very quick geek note on that one. That episode aired in Mercy, first appearance of the Klingons. I needed to point that out.
Oh,
okay.
Cool.
Go ahead.
You got serious geek cred on the original series beyond me. Number two here, once you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And
well, we know that's true because Sherlock Holmes said it. So Sherlock Holmes
right.
said it,
and
then Spock said it, and then later in The Next Generation, Data said it, and he said that it was an ancestor of his who, or is it Spock who said that an ancestor of his who said it? Anyway, it's
well. And the truth, and that's sort of a link to the fact that I think the writers are just nodding, giving credit where credit is due. Sherlock Holmes is an archetype that led in some ways to Spock, who led in some ways
so.
To
yeah.
Data, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So those characters owe a lot to each other. I think there's also just by happenstance, I think that this is true. I think it's just a statement of logic that, you know, if you can eliminate the impossible, whatever possibility remains, even if it seems improbable, must be true. I think that's just, you know, logically true.
If you never figured out that Sherlock Holmes was a precursor of Spock, they tried to make it as obvious as they could. And I think...
In the latest Star Trek.
They showed it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, finally, number one. Steven, I want you to know that I have been and always will be your friend. Okay,
and that's right.
The number one Spock quote: "The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one." And of course, that's Spock citing what he claims to be a principle that logic itself dictates, and in fact, I think is a moral principle that no logic will ever find. But that is absolutely essential for civilization to survive. So it's kind of the paradox of Spock in
right.
one statement right there. He's claiming logic while he's stating something that I'm not sure you can prove logically. What do you think?
Well, and I think it's also an important point that in the very next movie, when they all gave up and sacrificed Kirk lost his son, and you know they put their careers
That's
at risk
right.
and their lives at risk and everything for one person, and that was Spock. The quote was reversed.
Spock says, "Why did you do this?" And Kirk says, "Go ahead."
The needs of the one outweighed the needs of the many.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's an important point too. I mean, you know, you could take Spock's original quote and use that to justify, you know, the state, you know, doing anything it wanted to individuals, right?
Yep.
If taken too far. So Star Trek answered right back by saying, you know, individuals are pretty darn important too. And so that's, I like the original quote. I think it's true, but it's a decision to sacrifice yourself is a decision that person needs to make, you know, it doesn't need to be thrust upon them necessarily. The society deciding to sacrifice one as a scapegoat or something.
Well, ultimately, it sums up the paradox, doesn't it? The paradox of reason versus a human heart, the paradox of the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few, or the needs of the few outweighing the needs of the one outweighing the needs of the many, or I am Spock, I am not Spock, right? I mean, it's all there in the work and life of Leonard Nimoy, and we're much better off for his having been a part of our world, and we thank him. We thank you, Leonard Nimoy, for all that you gave to us. And Stephen, with a few seconds left, what's our music?
It's the Star Trek theme. I couldn't think of anything better. I mean, so tonight we're gonna play the orchestral music from Star Trek.
Fantastic. Thanks for putting that together. Join us next week. We're going to be talking with Sabrina Surovec. She's one of the finalists for the mission to Mars. You're not going to want to miss that. And until next time, live to see it.